You're listening to Femme Innovation, hosted by Bethany Corbin. Bethany is a trailblazing leader and top voice in women's health technology and femtech. She inspires entrepreneurs to transform society's perception of women's health by disrupting and enhancing standard models of healthcare delivery. In this podcast, Bethany connects with the industry's most powerful and innovative voices to facilitate hard conversations about the status of women's health and break down barriers and taboos that restrict access to necessary healthcare services. This podcast is not intended as legal advice and is not an endorsement for any product or company. Now, here's your host, Bethany Corbin.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Femme Innovation Podcast. On today's episode, we're going to talk about the historic exclusion of women from medicine, including how that exclusion has impacted women's ability to advocate for themselves and receive the care that they need and deserve in today's modern healthcare system. Joining me today for this discussion is Dr. Elizabeth Comen. You may be familiar with Dr. Comen already from her groundbreaking work in breast cancer, but she is also the author of the recent book, All in Her Head, The Truth and Lies Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today. The book has already become a USA Today bestseller. Dr. Comen has dedicated her medical career to saving the lives of women. She's an award-winning, internationally sought-after clinician and physician scientist. She's also a medical oncologist specializing in breast cancer at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and she's an assistant professor of medicine. Dr. Comen is the recipient of numerous grants and awards, including the Department of Defense Breakthrough Award for Breast Cancer, the American Society of Clinical Oncology Young Investigator Award, and multiple grants from the Breast Cancer Research Foundation and the Susan G. Comen Foundation. Really excited for this discussion and to dive into her book and what this exclusion means for women today. So welcome to the show, Dr. Comen. I am really excited to have you on the show and to have this conversation with you today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So before we dive into the specifics of your book, which for those of you who haven't read it is a page turner, can you tell us about your journey into women's health and what led you to focus your career on women's health care?
Well, it really goes back to college, and I had always been interested in the experience of illness and the contextual understanding of how we experience the biology and the bodies that we live in. So I majored in the history of science, which was really just such a joy while I was at Harvard. And I took a lot of classes on understanding the history of medicine, the history of science, and just how much culture, religion, politics influence our understanding of disease and what we are interested in studying. And then when I was in college, I volunteered at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, which is the cancer hospital affiliated with the Harvard Teaching Hospitals. And I initially started working with women in a boutique there who needed breast prostheses, something to put in their bra or wigs. And it had nothing to do with obviously getting chemotherapy, but really just how they felt about their bodies and how they felt going through a sickness. And for me, it really crystallized just how important it was to connect with people on a human level. At the same time, I started working in a lab there, studying the estrogen receptor, and it really married my joy of understanding science and organic chemistry and all the cool things that can happen in a lab with people. And I never really wavered in wanting to work with women and particularly breast cancer patients. So here I am today.
I love that. And you've been such an inspirational force in the field of breast cancer and women's healthcare to the point where you had a book deal with Harper Wave, which is an imprint of HarperCollins. So can you tell us what it was like getting that first book deal? And when did you realize you had a story to tell?
A story to tell. I think we all have stories to tell. And that's the thing about medicine is it really is so narrative. And one of the joys of my career is the sacred stories that patients tell me about their lives, what they want for themselves, what holds them back, what are the obstacles, and how I can help them thrive above and beyond what can be very algorithmic in terms of how you treat cancer. The idea that I could incorporate history and my love of history took a little bit of courage. Writing about cancer patients, I felt that I could do, but I wanted to have a more expansive takedown of just how screwed over I think women are in our healthcare system. And for me, that required believing in myself that even though I've read thousands of books about history of medicine, that I could actually tackle such an expansive whole topic such as women's health. And that's when I had the idea that we can walk through women's bodies by organ system, the same way that doctors learn about physiology at medical school, that really mirrors the specialties that we know today, like cardiology, gastroenterology, neurology. And I was really fortunate that there were different publishing houses that were interested, and Harper Wave, HarperCollins was the best deal.
That's phenomenal. And having read your book, I can say you do a terrific job of really weaving that history in with the patient narrative to the point where I couldn't put it down when I read it. I had to read it all in one sitting. And I'm somebody who is integrally involved in the healthcare field, but I learned so much that I did not know about our exclusion from healthcare. And truly, you know, one of the lines that really stuck with me from your book was in the introduction, where you wrote that the emotion that you encounter the most in the examination room, which is more potent and insidious than fear, is shame. So why do you think that women, more than men, actually feel that shame about their health and going to the doctor and the things that they can't control? Because I can tell you, I don't see the same level of shame in men going to the doctor.
I think that so much of what happens in our healthcare system mirrors our society. And that is why I wanted to include the history of medicine and an understanding of our culture and how that weaves inextricably into the experience of illness for women. We know that we apologize more. We know that we are more worried about what we wear walking down the street than the average man. And all the permutations of that shows up in the doctor's office in terms of what women are willing and comfortable to ask about their bodies, what they think they have a right to know about their bodies. And if you look at our current political system, it's not surprising that people are very worried about their access to care, access to reproductive health, let alone asking questions about their body that they may feel shame about.
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of my really good friends is a urogynecologist, and she has told me the countless patients that she sees who are so uncomfortable even talking to her about their health conditions to the point where she can't help them unless they're able to open up. And I think it's such a shame that we have that stigma and that taboo around women's healthcare still.
Well, we're working to take it down, right?
Exactly. And in your book, you talk a lot about the bias in medicine and its impact on patients, but it also impacts physicians as well. And I was curious, right, in your career path, what were some of the obstacles that you faced, especially working in women's health and as a female doctor?
Oh, good Lord. I have to be filtered in all my answers here, right? It's been a rocky road, I will say that. And I'm still trying to find my professional voice. I am not new to the party of being a doctor, but in terms of feeling empowered in my own professional space, I'm still working on that. I would say in medical school, I had many overtly inappropriate, egregious experiences of things that were said to me, ways that I was touched or groped, questions that I was asked. But I think it's a little more insidious as we become more aware of the things that women experience. But I definitely think that I'm not trying to hold back on my answers, but really just to say it's not been an easy road and I'm still working on that. And I think it's not enough to say, oh, we have more women in medicine, we graduate more female medical students. We have to think about who has positions of power, who's really listening to women. For those of us that become mothers, how we facilitate that or honor that, or in some ways make it really, really hard to practice medicine. There aren't that many part-time oncologists, and I had to go part-time in order to write this book for a year. And it shouldn't be that that every other industry like the law or finance can make those paths possible, and yet it's so impossible for a doctor to do. I think there's lots of ways that we could still be improving upon the system.
And, you know, as I was reading your book, I really felt myself starting to get angry over some of the continual misassumptions and dismissals that were associated with women in healthcare. And, you know, I'm in the women's health field. I know a lot of this, but as I mentioned earlier, right, like some of the stories in there are so shocking, from whether it's the history of breast implants, which I had no idea about, or the fact that women were told not to use bicycles. I was infuriated by some of that. And I was just curious, you know, as you were researching and diving into women's healthcare, what were some of the most surprising or infuriating stories that you learned as a part of your book, or that you think our audience might resonate with?
I was shocked the whole time. I mean, how is it that I care for women all day, every day? I've cared for thousands of women, and there's so much history that I didn't know. One of the biggest components, I think, that really was a thread throughout the book that just shocked me. And even towards the end, I was like, really? Are we really going with that? Is how much the fear of women's libido, sexual desire or lack thereof, or having it, who they were having it with and what that meant for them, and masturbation just infiltrated every aspect of medicine. For example, when I was researching the skeletal chapter and looking into history of scoliosis, I mean, why were there doctors saying that masturbation caused women to be lazy and in turn caused scoliosis? Like, what planet? That's like the going hypothesis, folks. Like, can we do a little bit better than that? Or you're hysterical and sex with your husband's going to cure that, but only when he wants to, and make sure it's only with your husband and only when you're married. I mean, the number of diseases, even asthma, I was like, can we like break down the physiology here? Why are we so focused on women's behavior? But yet, if you look at society, the idea of the free woman, the desiring woman, the woman who can either have a job or she can vote or she can ride a bicycle was at times very threatening to our culture. And in turn, doctors were in large part a product of that culture. And while there were definitely outliers and definitely lots of people with good intentions, the overarching zeitgeist was women needed to be controlled and that their bodies were primarily vessels for reproduction and becoming mothers. And yet when we age, we become less relevant. So particularly the postmenopausal woman. And think about our society today. I didn't know that Alzheimer's is 2 times as more likely among women than men. There were so many diseases of aging with respect to women that I was just not fully informed about. And I think that mirrors what we have cared about as a society and in turn, what we've invested in with respect to women's healthcare.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And it still dominates the dialogue that we have about women's healthcare today. Even the fact that we have to continuously say that women are more than their reproductive health organs. You do such a great job of really painting that picture in the book and how that has led to where we are today. And I would love to know, you know, as you were writing this book and bringing it to life and watching it become a bestseller, what do you want readers to take away from your book?
It's interesting. When I was writing this book, my agent asked me, do you want this to be descriptive or prescriptive? Meaning descriptive of a problem, but you're not really telling women what to do, or prescriptive, kind of like, here are the 10 steps you need to do when you go to the doctor's office. And for me, and maybe it's because my mom's a therapist, my dad's a lawyer, I think to really change something and to move the needle in women's healthcare required, for me, an understanding of where we are, where we've come from, and where we need to go. And that was descriptive in nature to me. I believe, to answer your question, that each of us has a body, a story, a history to our bodies. Every body that we're in has a story. It's a combination of the stories we've been told by society, the words we choose to describe ourselves and how we talk to ourselves, and the stories we've been passed down to us about our bodies. So my hope for this book is that when women read it, they may notice parts of themselves in that 17th century woman that was put in an asylum, or some of the characters or patients that I talk about in current day medicine, even if they don't have the same diagnosis. And if after reading this book, you can recognize some of yourself in the stories of this woman, is it possible for you to tell a different story about yourself? Can you go to the doctor's office feeling a little bit more empowered, a little less ashamed of your body, and a little bit more buttressed to ask the questions that you want and seek the healthcare that you want? So my hope is that it helps to change the narrative, not just for our society, but more on the individual level for the woman reading the book.
Oh, I love it. And I think it really will. You know, what I got out of the book was all about learning about the body, where we came from, and seeing how we had been excluded and repressed throughout medicine and even modern medicine today, and showing you are in charge of your healthcare. It's up to you now to advocate and help to shift that narrative. I love that this book is about empowering the individuals to see themselves and to really take that and be more confident and comfortable having those conversations, whether it's with friends, family, or their doctors. I think that's such a terrific goal with this book. And I think you accomplish it really well.
Thank you, Bethany.
Oh, of course. You know, and ever since I've been involved in the healthcare industry, I've started to see the femtech industry really start to grow. You know, coined in 2016, it's now worth over $1 billion. And it really grew as a way to help rectify the exclusion of women from modern medicine. And I'm curious about your take on the femtech industry. You know, is this something that is helping to shift the needle now in women's healthcare? Is femtech potentially going to be the future of women's health? Or do we need something else? Do we need something more?
I think it's a great start. And I also think we need to be investing in women's healthcare from head to toe. There's so much in the reproductive space evolving in the vaginal health space, but there are companies that are still selling douches or wipes that we do not need. We don't need to be investing. And it's like, you know, we used to recommend Lysol, or Lysol companies used to recommend their product as a vaginal douche, right? There are some healthcare companies that we don't need to be investing in, and others that I think are really unmet needs in terms of research opportunities, product development, understanding how medical devices may interact differently with women's physiology than men. lots of ways to support healthcare for women. And it's not just about our breast health or our reproductive function, but lots and lots of ways to get involved. And I think the more we can support these companies and really hold them to the type of science that we deserve and preclinical studies that we deserve, the better off we'll all be.
I think that's spot on. And, you know, one of the things that potentially worries me a little bit about the femtech industry that I see is some of the products that come to market don't have any type of scientific or clinical backing. And that worries me too, as kind of a way to take advantage of the gaps in women's healthcare and women.
Certainly, if you look at a lot of the wellness industry, I think it's very unwell for women. And the supplement industry, not to take it down entirely, but is tens of billions of dollars. Women are the primary consumers of that. And sometimes it's products that are truly unvetted and you don't know what's in there. And there have not been good studies on it and they're not regulated. And yet a lot of these industries are popping up because women do not feel cared for in the traditional medical system. They don't feel heard. And it's very enticing to scroll on Instagram and see ads that are essentially telling you, your doctor doesn't believe you, but I do. Your doctor doesn't have a solution, but I do. Mother Earth is going to provide you with this natural thing that's going to make you better all over. And of course, we know there's no natural, perfect, magic bullet out there. Medicine is extremely complex. But yet, when you don't feel cared for, a lot of these other things that are being sold to us and marketed to us become very enticing.
Oh, absolutely. And it's also interesting to see kind of the proliferation of healthcare advice on those social media sites like TikTok and Instagram, because as you said, women aren't comfortable and trusting in their healthcare providers to have these conversations. And so they're seeking healthcare from sources that are not necessarily reputable.
Right. I think the key thing is we can't say to women, oh my gosh, don't go on the internet. Don't go Google anything. Don't go to Instagram. Don't go to TikTok. That's just not realistic. I Google stuff as well, right? And please don't do it in the middle of the night. That's when our brains are kind of like unchecked, unfiltered, and there's no one else to call to be like, oh my God, like I have something terrible wrong with me. But I think the way that these internet sources and social media can be helpful is to help frame the questions that you may want to ask your doctor and a trusted professional. It's not to say that there's nothing good on the internet, but it needs to be contextualized. It needs to be within the conversation of an individual doctor-patient connection.
Beautifully said. You know, and while we're on the subject of trust, one of the doctors that you interviewed in the book notes that trust really makes all the difference whenever it comes to diagnosing patients properly. I know we've made a little bit of progress at least, you know, in terms of trust and women in the healthcare system, but do you think we've made enough progress on that front? Or do you think women are still pretty mistrustful of the healthcare system?
I think it depends on who you talk to. And it depends on, I don't want to generalize groups, but certainly minorities have had a terrible experience in our healthcare system and continue to. Black women, for example, are 40% more likely to die from breast cancer. And a lot of that is not from underlying biology or more aggressive tumors being found, but really lack of access, lack of resources, and experiences in our healthcare system that should just not be happening. So I think it's complicated. It depends, of course, on the individual and who we're talking about. But there's always more we can do to gain the trust of our patients and to create a system that's more empathic and compassionate and allows for, I know it sounds like a unicorn dream, and maybe it is, but less third-party players getting in the way of doctor-patient relationships and allowing the time for doctors, nurses, nurse practitioners to do what they do best. And so much of, I think, the mistrust in our healthcare system is because it's so compressed, it's so fractured that patients are not getting the breathing room to say what they need. And doctors are suffering as well because we want to be able to provide that. We don't want to see patients every 15 minutes. And you know what? We should be able to have lunch and go to the bathroom in the middle of a clinic day too. And sometimes that's just not the system that we're operating in.
Yeah, it's absolutely right. I mean, I remember one of my recent doctor appointments where my doctor was sitting in front of the computer the entire time and really didn't have time to kind of interact face to face. And I think that makes it less likely for somebody to open up.
Of course. Our electronic medical record system, all of these systems were made to make medicine more efficient, but in many ways, they have pulled us away from the patient. I mean, I can type like this and look at a patient this way, but it's awkward. You want somebody to be able to look at you and talk to you. But for every minute that we spend with a patient, we have to spend 3 minutes documenting. That is not a ratio that's appropriate. It should be tipped towards the interaction with the patient, not something that's going on outside the exam room. The albatross of medical documentation, order entry and clicking literally like an automaton into a computer is not the way that medicine should be practiced, period, end of story.
100% agree. And I think it contributes to the vast rates of burnout that we have as well going on in the medical system.
It's not even a think, it does. If you look at the surveys of why doctors feel so burnt out, much of it relates to wanting to practice medicine in the compassionate way that they want, the moral injury that occurs when they cannot, and also the absolute overwhelming burden of administrative tasks that don't actually improve our healthcare.
Absolutely. You know, and one of the things that I loved about your book too is just the title. I have to say, All in Her Head. It really spoke to me because my mom actually had an illness when I was a kid and it was undiagnosed for 8 years. And after running all of the tests, that's literally what all the doctors told her. It was in her head. They couldn't find anything wrong and it must be psychosomatic. And so I'm curious, you know, having written this book and looked at all the history of women's healthcare, you know, why do you think women's symptoms are so frequently written off as anxiety and told that they're in their head?
Yeah, I think there's a long history of that we can work to dismantle. If you look at the history of the word hysteria, it comes from the Greek word for womb, which goes all the way back to this ancient idea that we're crazy because our womb wanders all over and that's what wreaks havoc all over our body. And I do think that the ghost of the hysterical woman, the anxious woman, has infiltrated our entire approach to medicine, that even though we don't refer to women as hysterical that much anymore in the medical setting, we certainly do still as a society. It's been removed from the medical lexicon as a diagnosis, but in many instances, I think it's been replaced with the anxious woman or someone who just has everything all in her head. And part of that is because we don't always understand what's going on with women because we have not necessarily studied their conditions as well as we should have. Over 80% of autoimmune diseases are in women, and sometimes we don't even have the right label or right test for them. And I think once we have more gender parity in terms of who's caring for women, some of these specialties that have been underserved for women, whether it's orthopedic surgery, urology, once we level those playing fields a little bit, we'll have more names and ways to treat disease and understand them better. And therefore, in turn, not just call women anxious when they're in pain or to calm down when they're worried about something that's been going on for forever and no one's diagnosed it.
Oh, 100%. I know we're almost out of time for today's episode, but I do want to end kind of on that prescriptive note, right? I know your book is very descriptive in nature too, but for those who read it and they say, oh my gosh, I'm outraged. You know, I want to advocate for myself. I want to change this narrative. How can we pick up that torch, right? And continue the movement forward and demand better for women's healthcare?
Well, you said it. I mean, that's where it starts. It starts with the energy to say that my body matters. I deserve good healthcare. If I don't find it with the first doctor, get a second opinion. It also means that you may need somebody with you to help advocate for you, whether it's a family member or a friend who helps you craft questions and show up for you in a doctor's appointment, especially when you're anxious, to help be that litmus test and barometer for, are you getting the information that you need? Because if you're anxious, if you're worried, it's hard to absorb information and understand all of it that you're trying to process in the moment that may feel differently when you go home. It's very important that you figure out who's on your care team, who are all the different players, whether it's nurse, nurse practitioner, doctor, administrative person that's going to be scheduling you. Know how that network, that complex ecosystem works so you can advocate for who you're going to be talking to. It may not be that your doctor is going to call you back every time. Know that in advance so you can help understand and triage where your questions are going to go and how you're going to get the best answers. Really clarifying how you want to be communicated with and how you want to receive information is also really important. And at the end of the day, also remembering if you have that one question or thing that you've always wanted to know or that's always worried you, now is the time to advocate for yourself and ask it.
Beautifully said. Thank you so much for being with us today, Dr. Komen. This has been so enlightening. I have loved the book and I'm so glad that we got a chance to talk about it. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your support and all the mission.
And to all of our listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. We hope to see you for the next episode.
Thanks for listening to Femme Innovation with Bethany Corbin. To connect with Bethany, follow FemTech Lawyer on Twitter and Instagram. Visit her website at FemInnovation.com and connect with her on LinkedIn. If you found value in this show, we'd really appreciate a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. That helps others find the show. Thanks again for tuning in to this episode of Femme Innovation with Bethany Corbin. We hope you'll join us again next time.